And welcome once again, folks, to All Things Trek here on TrekRadio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
So I heard...
Wait for it.
What are we waiting for?
I don't know. Something to go wrong. Wait. Nothing's going wrong? Okay. Keep going.
Okay. All right. We are here. It is 1 p.m. in the West, 4 p.m. in the East. Other times, elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
I care about them, but not so much to mention them.
Not enough to learn their time zones.
I could just go around the world just adding an hour.
Yeah, I suppose you could.
Yeah, Atlantic Ocean, Europe, you know, all the way around. But anyway, so, I heard that you watched some more of Voyager.
You did. this is a thing that I've been doing, and it is...
I mean, you're filling in the gaps, from what I
understand,
right?
And then there are a couple episodes that, like, I think I might have watched so long ago that I've forgotten them. Like, I watched Voyager Conspiracy, and then I watched Muse the other night, and I was aware of Voyager Conspiracy. I can't say for sure that I ever watched it, but I knew the basic premise. And that episode is weird. Like,
well, that's where Seven installs a new cortical processor thing, right? And she starts coming up with all these weird conspiracies.
Downloads way too much information. You know, it's kind of what I imagine what would happen if you tried to download the internet. and like, she starts coming up with these conspiracies, and it's like, it's kind of hard to tell, like, if the writer is maybe trying to poke fun at Voyager, because there are certain things she brings up that are clearly just fabrications of her own mind, and then there are other things where it's like, wait, that doesn't make sense. Why are you pointing out this thing that showed it that doesn't make sense? Like, the tri-cobalt devices that they used to destroy the caretaker's array, which always really weirded me out. I was just like, why did they make a special... like, bomb to blow up the caretaker's array? Why didn't they just use a photon torpedo?
Like, this tri-cobalt's way bigger and better.
Yeah, but we don't know what that is. Like, they say tri-cobalt device, and, like, later they explain that a tri-cobalt device is way more powerful, but it's like, dramatically it would have just made more sense to use weapons that they already knew. That we already knew about, like photon torpedoes. That way we wouldn't have had to wonder why Voyager was carrying these super bombs, and why we never used them again. Which is something that they never explain in the Voyager Conspiracy. They just do not explain it.
Yeah.
Also, they have fleas that apparently their natural food source is plasma. And I was like, how did that even... Like, whatever.
Who are you to judge?
The funniest part about that episode is, like, the line of, like, conspiracy information that Janeway feeds... Actually, not Janeway, that Seven feeds to Chakotay is like, alright, this is a little far-fetched... But it's kind of plausible. Like, if you assume that everything Seven is telling you is true and is not just stuff that she made up, which I'm assuming she had to have made up some of it, especially just there's some of it that is just kind of hard to reconcile. But
well,
like,
she was processing a bunch of information and facts and drawing conclusions on those facts on chains of events that were just false conclusions.
Well, sort of, but like,
I mean,
it's
supposed to be what I thought, and when I saw the episode, was it was supposed to be sort of highlighting and pointing out how conspiracy theorists nowadays are. Well, they'll take like a series of events or some facts and draw a conclusion from it, saying this is their motive, this is what they're doing, this is their end goal.
Right, right.
You know, Alex Jones, for instance, I think would be a good example of that.
I don't know what that is.
Alex Jones, he's one of the guys who is. Talking about like the New World Order and how the elite are going to, you know, one day have enough control to gas a whole bunch of us and reduce the world's population by like, I don't know, like 80% or something like that. I forget.
Sure, why not?
Yeah. So I think that's kind of what it was supposed to be. Is
sort of, but here's the thing. Like, the one piece of, like, some of it is just stuff that they bring up that just doesn't make sense, and it's like, it's kind of weird that you would call attention to that. But the piece of information that's key to all this is that Seven, like, thinks that she sees a tractor beam, like, pulling one of the caretaker's arrays out of the explosion, and, like, it's never explained if that was just something she, like, her, like, disease, like, information mad mind created, or if there was actually something there, or if it was just, like, a mistake that she made looking at this thing and thinking it was a tractor beam. And that's kind of the thing... That's sort of what started all of it. Because if there was a tractor beam there, that implied... That, like, really showed that there was something weird going on. and that was sort of at the heart of everything, and they never really stopped to ask, is this piece of information that you're asserting true? Because everything else that you've built depends on this one piece of information. If that turns out to be false, everything else comes crumbling down.
Yep.
But, like, you know, but that's, like, the thing.
And then you have the muse, right?
But the other thing about that episode that's weird is that the line of conspiracy theories that Seven Feast Chakotay is kind of believable. Like, it's goofy, but I can sort of see how you could believe it if you were in the right frame of mind. The line of a conspiracy theory that Seven feeds Janeway is so incredibly thin that I can't believe Janeway didn't start laughing. But Janeway apparently believes it just as readily as Chakotay does, which says all kinds of things about Janeway's personality and what she thinks is going on. They also bring up how Janeway keeps stopping to explore, like, some random thing on their way home. Like, my favorite is the exploding nebula. They don't actually bring up the exploding nebula by name, but that was one of my favorites. Let's go explore this random thing.
Well, that was one of the kind of the, I guess you could say, decrees that Janeway and Chakotay had laid out. Because Janeway and Chakotay had a conversation in the first episode about, well, what are we going to do about this business here? And the conclusion was that they're going to be a Starfleet crew, and while they're heading home, they're going to keep carrying out, you know, their exploration directive.
Eh.
Which, you know, not what my priority would be necessarily. But
I find it really hard to believe that Chakotay would care, and that they would go through all this trouble. Especially, like, I mean, it's one thing if you explore something weird and new that no one has ever seen before, but on the other hand, like, you know, exploring the nebula that, I forget what episode this was in, but there was a nebula that was supposed to be exploding and wasn't exploding, and they were like, let's fly into this thing and hope it doesn't explode, because we need to explore, gosh darn it. And it's like...
A solid plan.
That doesn't sound like something that the Enterprise would have done. It sounds like they would have, like, you know, called for, like, a specially designed probe to go in there and, you know, in case it exploded. But I don't know, so there's that. And then I watched Muse, and Muse is just... Like, oh my god, I want to kill the alien playwright. I want to strangle him with, like, my bare hands. Because, you know, I occasionally pretend to be a writer, and his whole thing of, like, I can't write if I don't have inspiration. And it's like, dude, man up. You're getting paid, okay? This isn't just, like, something that you're just doing in your spare time when inspiration strikes. This is a job, okay?
Yep.
It's like, you know... Like, no one asks me if I'm feeling inspired enough to pack things at the warehouse when I wake up in the morning. It's not something that you're doing because you feel inspired. It's something because you're doing because someone is paying you money for it.
Uh-huh.
And this, I don't know, the whole thing is just really goofy. Oh, also in the Voyager conspiracy, they can establish instant communication over 5,000 light years, but they can't, like, just beam a message towards Earth and wait for a response in a week or so.
Well,
no.
Is this where they...
They have, like... This is the one with
the... Is Pathfinder a thing in this episode?
No. What it is it's... Well, it has happened at that point. But no, what it is it's...
Is that the Hirogen Network?
The Hirogen Network, but that's a different episode. This episode, the technology they have is this catapult, and, like, that flings ships a long way. And so, you know, the ship that is building it, he goes through it. And then he's, like, 5,000 light years away, and they're communicating in real time.
Oh!
And it's like, wait a minute, you guys are going to have real-time communication over 5,000 light years? But you couldn't just, you know, again, you just want to just beam a communication at Earth and maybe wait a week for a response. You know, it just doesn't sound like that. It doesn't sound that hard. I don't know. That episode is goofy.
Technical strikes again.
Yeah. All right. Did we have any... We had some other announcements, I thought.
We have a contest still going on.
We do.
Snap. So, because we're lazy, we don't want to actually make this. But we do want one, which is a new intro to our show. It has to be about, what, 90 seconds, you think?
Yeah, about 90 seconds. And a half.
Yeah, about a minute and a half. And longer than that, it starts to get a little tiring. But anyway, here are some of the stipulations. If you would like to enter, 18 years or older, you must be. All entries must be in MP3 format. Please keep your entry shorter than 90 seconds. You must have a valid email address. And the entry deadline is August 31st at 8 p.m. Pacific, 11 p.m. Eastern. Do the conversion if you're on a time zone. But anyway, you've got like 2 months to do it.
Yeah. And if you want all that in print, you can find that on our website, allthingstrek.com.
Just click on the link that says CONTEST!
It has three exclamation marks.
It does.
One or two would not be enough.
It wouldn't have been enough. And the prize is a $50 Amazon.com gift card, which you can use if you're in another country. You just have to use Amazon.com.
Right. Oh, and for reference, this is not really Star Trek. It's a bit of a tangent. But I played Artemis the other week, and it's really fun.
I want to play it.
It's fun. You would really love being the engineer. The engineer is like a full-time job. We made the mistake of having my brother try to be the helmsman and the engineer. it's not a thing. Because, like obviously, the helmsman has to steer the ship and raise the shields for some reason. I thought that would be the tactical officer's job, but whatever. The helmsman steers the ship. But the engineer has two things that he does. He can tell damage control teams where to go. And the damage control teams have a pretty good AI on their own. They will repair without being told what to do. But if you have a system that you need repaired first, you can tell them to go there.
Nice.
And I really like how one of the things that can get damaged is hallways. And so your damage control team can't get through the damaged hallway to repair the other thing.
How close to like Dwarf Fortress is this? Is playing the engineer?
It's not that close.
Okay.
It's way more user-friendly.
Because I'm having an image of like Dwarf Fortress.
But like
a starship.
It's way more user-friendly than that. But the other thing you do, the thing that actually takes up a lot of time, is power management.
Okay.
And you don't ever have to touch those dials, but if you are like, if you have a full-time engineer and he's just staring at the power dials and adjusting them as you go, you can get a lot more performance out of your ship. It's like, you know, like right now, we are flying directly at the enemy ship. We don't need our rear shields. Let's turn down the rear shields. Oh, crap. Pardon me. We've just passed them. We need our rear shields back on, like right now. Turn off the front shields. Or like we're really close to them. We can turn off the we can lower sensors because we're really close. We don't need more sensors. Or like, you know, cycling the power to your torpedo tubes. And like, you know, turning it off when they've been disabled and then turning it back on once your repair crew's finished fixing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of micromanagement there that I think you would have a lot of fun with.
Right on. I dig it.
Yeah, the game is a lot of fun. So far, we've had some problems connecting it with people who weren't all connecting to the same modem. I don't know why exactly. I don't know if that's something that's weird.
So it's more LAN-friendly than it is internet-play-friendly.
Yeah, but it's not actually a LAN. Like, everyone is connecting through the internet, but they're all connect. But we haven't been able to join games that weren't all hosted to the same modem, and I don't know why that is. I'm trying to experiment to figure out if it was just a specific issue with the people we were playing with, or if it's something about the game. Because the game website says you can play online. So I don't know what's up with that. And at some point, I really want to try PvP with that game.
Is that a function in it?
Yeah.
Sweet.
It's not like an intended function. It was originally, like, the guy wanted you to be able to play, this, like, you know, multiple ships in the same mission. But, you know, you can just make a mission of the map with no ships but you and the other ship, and then you can fight.
Sweet.
It's a thing you can do.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is.
My bridge crew against your bridge crew. I like that. That's a really awesome idea.
Yeah, I totally want to do that. The problem is this game is really hardware intensive, because you need so many computers for it. Not like hardware, like your system specs don't have to be very good.
You just need a lot of computers. A lot of computers, yeah.
All right. So, anyway, that's my Artemis pitch. If you guys don't know what Artemis is, look it up.
Starship Artemis.
It's really good.
I have installed on my computer. It's sitting there. I haven't played it yet.
Well, we will figure it out how to let you play with us.
So, I want to bring up a point.
Yeah?
That we were talking about before the show.
Uh-huh.
And how Star Trek Online is a festering sore.
Okay, look, all right.
I think I'm quoting you.
All right, so here's
Star Trek IP.
So this is my thing about Star Trek Online. I've just come to the conclusion that if someone gave me a button and said, if you press this button, you will get $1 million, but you will destroy Star Trek Online forever, I would press the button and then give them their $1 million back. Because I don't know, Star Trek Online, it just sounds like every time, and granted, this is all stuff that I am hearing from people who play the game a lot. I don't play it. I tried playing it, and I was just like, this is boring.
You didn't get a tutorial.
I tried to play through the tutorial, and I was like, I no longer have any interest in this game. But, like, it seems like it's just not a very good game, and every time Cryptic does something, they make it worse. Like, and it just, it seems like they've, it's, from what I've heard, it sounds like they've basically given up on any kind of large amount of story content, and they've got one guy working to fix PvP, one guy who, as I understand it, doesn't have a very good track record, and so I'm like, what's left? like, if you're not focusing on story content, and you're not focusing on, like, you know, single player or multiplayer PvE, and you're not focusing on PvP, what else is there to do in this game? And it honestly sounds like what it is it's they're hoping for people to, like, log into the game, buy a few things, play through some levels, get bored, leave, and then the next people will show up.
That would certainly be the impression that anyone who hasn't played this before, or I guess anyone who has played it, period, or hasn't played it before, coming in right now would see.
Because, like, I understand that you and Terry from Podcast UGC had a lot of fun with your alts that you made and just played the game from square one.
Yep.
And you thought that was fun, but once you got to end level, you had nothing to do. And so,
yeah,
it seems like that's what they're going for, and I just don't think that's a very good game model. Like, if leveling, if hitting max level is a bad thing, it's like, eh? Like, I mean, you know, for all my hatred of World of Warcraft, that game doesn't really start until you hit max level. Like, there's so much to do at max level.
Yeah.
And I'm just sort of, and I've heard a lot of, like, I don't know, a lot of debate between, in, like, you know, like, should we have story content or should we have PvP? I don't see any reason why you couldn't have both. Or, like, you know, I've also heard, like, a lot of things about people saying, well, maybe the Foundry can take over providing, like, story content. It's like,
well, that's actually a particular point that's been mentioned by, I think, Dan Stahl, and this is kind of secondhand, I'm hearing about it, but it was on the forums. I think it was a post by the Grand Negus, which I'm sure anybody who's been on the Star Trek Online forums all knows who the Grand Negus is, and his penchant for getting banned several times. Uh-huh. And keep coming back. He tries so hard. I gotta give him a pat in the back just out of sympathy for how hard he tries to try to ask the questions and you know, try to make the audience, I suppose, and the community just more engaged and try to think more critically about what's going on by just posing the questions. It was that Dan Stahl was saying, or it was a quote or so about what Dan had said about having Foundry content replace older content.
Well, like, the idea being that, like, Foundry authors would be providing the single-player story stuff, or at least the PvE story stuff.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, okay, I could see that, but you'd have to give the player something a lot better than the Foundry. Like, you'd have to just give them the dev tools and say, go nuts. Use this to make your mission. And at that point, you'd be like, all right, well, we are paying for the use of these tools so we can create these stories and these games for each other.
Yeah.
And then you could have them focus on the dynamic PvP environment or something. Because right now, it just seems like they're coming up with more and more ways to get people to, like, spend some money and then leave.
Yeah.
And it's just,
well, they say that they're trying, that their focus right now is to, you know, beef up endgame so that there is stuff for people to do that are level 50, which is endgame level, like, you know, myself or Terry or Hav or anybody, you know, yeah, anybody that's playing this game that has a Vice Admiral character. But I don't see that being a PvE story progression so much, because that has been too expensive to do, apparently.
Yeah.
I mean, because we look at the feature episodes, for instance, and I had kind of posed this to Terry a little bit on Podcast UGC, which was, you know, how many times have you actually played the FEs on, like, one character, and it was only, like, a couple times since they come out. Now, that's a terrible return on investment for any sort of content with an MMO. Are they good stories? Eh, that's debatable, as we've debated several times, not only on this podcast, but others. But people aren't going to stay just because the story is good. Typically, like, when I read a book, for instance, I've read that book once, it goes on my shelf. You know, I might read it again later on, but, you know, it's the story. Once I've played through that story, I'm not really interested in reading it again.
Yeah, see.
You know, it's an MMO, and it's a video game, and the idea behind a video game, more so, is seeing progression for your character in the case of an MMO. And that can be a story progression. It would just have to be a different story every time I log in. And I don't get that necessarily right now with Star Trek Online. And it's not going to come out at a quick enough pace to be able to keep me satiated if we're talking about just cryptic done stuff.
Yeah.
Now, there's plenty of Foundry stuff. There's so much Foundry stuff out there. You know, and a lot of those missions are really good. Some of them are also really bad. So, but, you know, if I had to choose one entity or the other to keep PvE story content going, it would have to be the Foundry community.
Well, see, I think, well, the Foundry community is crowdsourcing, and I think crowdsourcing is a great idea for how to continually produce more story that would otherwise be prohibitively expensive.
Yep.
But I think that if they're going to depend on that, they need to give you better tools.
I agree that we do need better tools, and Also, EULA clarification, but I won't get into that. Anybody who wants to know about the EULA, go listen to the last episode of Podcast UGC, episode 65, I think.
Yeah,
is what
that's,
we got.
That's the one.
But, because there are some people out there, and I'm going to give a shout-out to Alamac 30. He's produced some awesome stuff with just the base tools that we've got. I'm sure if you hand the actual dev tools to him, I'm sure he'd be able to come up with something really awesome. You might have to wait probably a year for it, because he spends like 6 months on his missions typically, because he goes in, tweaks something, and looks at it again, and is, you know, fiddling with it constantly. But yeah, if we had better tools as a Foundry community, or if we had access to the dev tools, I'm sure there'd be people out there who would produce some really awesome stuff that'd be on the level of Cryptic, if not better. Because we already have stuff that is better than Cryptic missions already in the Foundry.
Right. And of course, they would also produce a lot of stuff that's really bad, but you don't have to play that stuff.
Yeah, you don't have to play the bad stuff if you don't want to. That's right.
I mean, I don't know. I'd be interested, if Star Trek Online actually went away, I'd be interested to see if we would get any, like, if there just wouldn't be any Star Trek games. Because, like, at first I thought it was like a contract issue. Like, I wasn't sure if Cryptic owning the rights to make Star Trek Online meant that no other company could make any Star Trek games, because sometimes they bundle those rights together.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, Bethesda thought that it owned the rights to make all Fallout games, but then I think Activision is the company that owns, that like, licensed them those rights, said, nah, you guys don't own the rights to make the MMO, you only own the rights to make the single-player game.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big, like, lawsuit over that. But I looked at it, and, like, the only Star Trek game that had, like, even been proposed since Star Trek Online came out was Infinite Space, I think it was called.
Infinite Space,
and
which
that
is going to be a browser
just,
game by GameForge.
Yeah, that just failed, I think, because of funding issues. But that indicated that other companies could make a Star Trek game if they wanted to, and if they got the license from CBS. So, but I don't know. Maybe if Star Trek Online went away, we would see more of those, or maybe we just wouldn't have any Star Trek video games for a while. Frankly, I'd be okay with that. I mean, I'd rather have, like, nothing for a while than what we have now, which is, like, a lot of people, like, are being introduced to or seeing Star Trek through Star Trek Online, which I just don't think is a very good way to get introduced to it.
No, I don't really think so either.
That's just my opinion, and take that for what you will. And part of it is definitely tinged by the fact that I don't like MMOs in general. I'm just not an MMO player when it comes right down to it. And I was really interested in Star Trek Online because of the Foundry, and then I found out how limited the Foundry is and how poorly supported it is, and it's just like, well, there you go, I'm out. all right, so we have some emails.
Email. Which came in, like, at the last minute, too.
I think they're trying to surprise us. They're, like, hoping we won't have time to read them before we read them on the air. So this one is from our friend Johnny Q.
Johnny Q!
Bob, go ahead.
Hey, guys! Enjoyed the monster episode. A few more that I thought might merit a mention include the DS9's Solaren Prin, a half-burned Cardassian who assassinates the former Shi'kar Resistance members from Kira's old cell, and a delightful Phantom of the Opera turned by actor Randy Oglesby, who will later go on to play Degra in Enterprise. He was a pretty compelling monster. What does he play? He played Degra?
Did he? I barely remember who Degra even was.
Oglesby, that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
You don't remember who Degra was?
No, I don't.
He's like the scientist mind behind that whole Death Star weapon.
Oh, that was his name?
Yes.
Okay, I knew who that character was, I just forgotten his name.
Okay. Alright. Also, thought I mentioned Voyager's D'Jarin?
D'Jarin. I think that's correct. D'Jarin.
D'Jarin?
I'm going to say D'Jarin.
Not sure. It's been a long time since I've seen that Voyager episode. A psychotic hologram played by the inimitable?
Inimitable? I don't know what that word means. I assume it means cool.
All right. Leland Orser. Orser, who previously had turns as a crazed victim. As crazed victim. I really want to read these word for word. who previously had turns as a crazed
or
victim.
Just
in
as
the
crazed
film
victims in the films.
Seven, and Alien Resurrection portrays the creepiest hologram in Star Trek history. D'Jarin was undoubtedly inspiration for the Bonnykin hologram in Star Trek Online.
I don't know what
that
is.
Johnny Q. Well, there's there's the Davidian featured episode series, which is has to do, obviously, with Davidians, mm-hmm. right? And they're going back in time to the 23rd century and and taking people's neural energy and stuff from what's called Drazana Station, which is like a K-7 copy-paste.
Well, that's no good.
Yeah. But there's this one particular mission in there where there's this hologram who is reciting this poem, which is Bonnykin, Bonnykin, all dressed in red, Bonnykin, Bonnykin, soon you'll be dead.
And that's creepy.
The atmosphere, since it's all dark, all you have is a flashlight to see where you're going and what's going on around you.
I think I've heard of this mission, actually. That sounded pretty cool.
And it's voiced. Mm-hmm. And the voice actor that does it is pretty good. I gotta say, it's not a bad mission in that regard, because it definitely kind of got me going a little bit. I was like, ooh, this is kind of scary.
A little scary.
Like, I think that was actually released kind of over Halloween, too.
All right. Well, that's definitely... Thanks for the email, Johnny Q. That could definitely count as a good monster. I'm glad someone enjoyed the Monsters episode. I thought it was pretty embarrassing, personally.
We're so bad at this.
Right, a crystalline entity. It's only, like, one of the most famous aliens from TNG. Whatever. We could totally be excused for forgetting that one.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have this next one here from Chris.
Chris, to Bob and Oren. Because, you know... There's no one else on the show. After hearing your thoughts on the rock monster that never was in Star Trek V, I feel the need to honorably mention a similar one not mentioned for obvious reasons. What about the rock monster from Galaxy Quest?
Oh, man. I forgot about that.
Although Galaxy Quest isn't a Star Trek movie, I keep hearing some fans commenting on it as being a Trek movie in spirit, so I figured I'd bring it up in this light. Also, when I wrote to you about why you like your favorite starships, given that you've delved into why you didn't like certain ones brought up as examples, I've been also curious about other ships you know of in canon or otherwise official material, such as games, that you guys don't like. What are some notable ones that come to mind?
Well, hang on. Are we skipping? The chat room says we're skipping. That might just be because when you
go outside for an hour and all shit hits the fan. Well, that's because they probably haven't refreshed.
Oh, yeah. Apparently, on Trek Radio, you have to refresh whenever the stream changes hands. So hopefully that'll fix it. Because when we checked, we weren't skipping.
Yep. Anyway. Oh, do we get another email?
No, Hotmail's just being cranky.
Okay. All right. No. Yeah, we just read that one. All right.
So this is what we get for using Hotmail.
All right. So, well, we kind of have this as a secondary topic.
Yeah, don't worry. We actually do want to talk about this. We will get to it. So thank you for...
You want to talk about it now?
Sure. I mean, we've got this email. Oh, by the way, I love Galaxy Quest. I agree. Galaxy Quest is totally a Trek movie. Not like... Obviously not officially. But it's a spoof on Trek movies, but it's a loving spoof on Trek movies. I think the people who made it must be really big Star Trek fans.
Mm-hmm.
Just because there's so many, like, you know, at the end of it, it's like... You know, even though it is a spoof, at the end of it, it still makes you feel pretty good about what they did. And it's like, yeah, this is cool. And I can totally see that being, a Star Trek movie in spirit.
Yeah, totally.
But anyway. So, all right, so spaceships. All right.
Yeah, all right. So, I guess the question is, I've been curious about other ships you know of in canon, or in other words, official material, such as games. I'm not sure I would call games official material.
Quasi-official.
They're
official because CBS said they're official, and CBS owns the IP, so...
Yeah, but you guys
or Paramount, before CBS was a thing.
What are some notable ones that come to mind?
Oh, well, first up, Voyager. Just straight
the
up.
The Intrepid class?
I hate Voyager. I hate, like, the ship. I don't like... Or, I guess maybe hate's a strong word. I don't like the Intrepid class. I think it looks kind of goofy. Because one of the reasons why I really like Star Trek, like, Starfleet ships... is that they're not phallic at all. And I think Voyager is just kind of phallic-looking. And then it's got those nacelles, which are just kind of stupid. So it's like, when we have to go to warp, our nacelles have to go up and down, which not only slows us going to warp and makes it harder to warp out of somewhere in a crisis, but means that we have these giant structural weak points because we have these enormous hinges. And anyone who makes armor will tell you that the weakest place is the weakest points on the armor are the places where it has to bend.
Yeah,
so,
true.
Like, I don't know. And, like, I guess it goes a little bit faster than the Enterprise-D, but not that much faster. And I don't really think that that was a worth it trade, personally.
It had something to do with the warp geometry or something like that.
It has a lot of things to do with the warp geometry. I don't know. It was a thing to try to make Voyager look different and unique, and I just didn't like it. Just straight up.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's you know, an artist doesn't necessarily want to keep copying the same design elements over and over and over. Artists want to do new things. And case in point of this is, what's his name? From the Star Trek Online art team, the ship guys, Jam Jams, I think is his name? Help me out, chat room, if you know what their name is. I think it's Jam Jams. And the impression I got with the interview that they had with Chris on Stoked was that they didn't really enjoy working on Starfleet ships so much, because they all kind of have the same design elements. There's not much you can experiment with. And they're far more excited about working on, like, alien ships, because no idea what they look like, and they could just make something new.
Sure, no, definitely. I can understand that. And I understand wanting to make a ship look different. And, like, that's, you know, Voyager, they tried something new, didn't work out all that well. That's the nature of trying new things. You can never be sure if they're going to work. But, like, you know, so that's one that the Prometheus is another one. I really don't like the Prometheus.
Please,
I don't like.
Tell me why, please.
Well, from an aesthetic standpoint, I think a ship that splits into smaller ships is just kind of dumb. And especially from, like, a logical standpoint, it's like, what benefit would that possibly leverage?
Well, you've turned, like, one target into three targets. This is what you've done with multi-vector assault, which is what the...
Yeah, but you've turned them into three easier-to-kill targets.
Well, why are they necessarily easier to kill?
Because they're smaller.
Yeah, but it's like assault craft.
But they're not small enough to be harder to hit. So, like, I mean, what you need for this is you need, like, three redundant power supplies for this, like, you know, for this ship. Like, three redundant sets of systems for everything. Which means that you're going to end up with three ships that are just not very well... They're just not very powerful. And you might as well just make three separate ships at that point. There's not really any benefit to having
them...
But
now we have these three separate ships that make one powerful super ship.
That's not really how it works. You need, like, three sets of shield generators, three sets of weapons, three sets of life support systems. You need three sets of everything. Again, you might as well just make three ships. There's not really any reason to have them link up like that. Like, either they're either more efficient as one ship, in which case they should just stay one ship, or they're more efficient as three ships, in which case they should just be three ships. Like, when it comes right down to it. I mean, I don't know. Like, it just... I have a hard time... This just seems like way more trouble than it's worth. Like, it doesn't seem to get you any... It doesn't seem to leverage any benefit. You know? Like, that's why I don't like the Prometheus.
I don't know. I think it's of tactical benefit to have, you know, more targets available to your enemy to try to figure out what to do with.
I mean,
that is to have one target, you know?
I mean, maybe...
Yeah, plus, since we have the ship that splits into three, right? We have the Prometheus here. And if damage occurs to one of it, the other two sections of it are still good to go. So, in the case you're, which I don't know if this is actually how the ship is structured or not, where it has, like, three redundant power supplies that are equal to each other necessarily or anything like that, because if we want to take, like, the Galaxy class as an example, all it had in the saucer section were the impulse reactors.
Well, the saucer section is a little bit more forgivable, because the saucer section is, its only purpose is to evacuate the non-essential members of the crew in a crisis.
Well, right.
Or maybe the entire crew if the ship's about to explode.
Right, but I just wanted to use the saucer as an example real quick of a power supply. We'll get to the Galaxy Cluster in a minute, because I've got my own gripes about it. In a tactical situation, it's always better to outnumber your enemy and come in from several different angles than it is to have one entity come in from one angle.
Oh, wait, hang on. This is hilarious.
What's
in the chat room, I just got accused of not watching Star Trek. That's funny.
Oh, right. By Hawk?
Yeah.
Yeah, well...
It's
yeah.
Cool. No, I mean, the rest of it is totally fair. Like, he could say that I hate Voyager and that I don't play Star Trek Online. That's true. The thing that I think is funny is that he accused me of not watching Star Trek.
Yeah, well...
All right, anyway, keep going.
Especially since we just talked about it.
It's funny because at the beginning of the show, I was just talking about episodes that I'd watched.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, yeah. But, anyway, it is tactically better to come in from three different angles with three different ships, all right, well, three of the same ship, than it is to come in with one ship from one angle.
All right, but let's look at it this way. All right, so let's assume that the Prometheus has a shield value of 99, just mathematically. It has a shield value of 99. That means that when it splits, like, those ships are all going to have shield values of 33, which means that if you can get through, like, if you're shooting at the Prometheus and you get its shields down to 66%, or if you get it down to 66, the ship is still intact, but if you get one of its parts down using that same amount of weapons power and get and eliminate 33 points of shielding, now you can just destroy that ship, and now it's just lost a third of its effectiveness, whereas they were all one ship. Unless each of those little ships has the same shield strength as the Prometheus when it's together, in which case it doesn't have any benefit from being linked up as one ship. Like, there's really... You're right. It is a tactical advantage to be able to attack your opponent from three directions at once. So you should just have three ships! Linking them together like that just makes a bigger... If you have three ships that all function independently, and you link them together, all that you get is a bigger, slower, harder-to-move ship.
I'm going to look up the Prometheus real quick.
Okay, you look up that Prometheus.
Prometheus starship.
Why are you looking up the Prometheus?
Here we go. Memory Alpha.
What about the Prometheus?
Well, mostly because I want to...
So it's too late to read Memory Alpha stuff, Bob. We should have done this before we started the show. By the way,
here we go. Defensive systems. The Prometheus class was designed with an unprecedented level of automation and combined with its advanced tactical systems, one of the most powerful combat ships in the Alpha Quadrant. The primary battle systems on board the Prometheus include generative shielding, ablative armor, as well as phasers and photon torpedoes.
Yeah, whatever.
The feature of the multi-vector assault mode, which has allowed the ship to split into three semi-independent sections that could each deliver massive force against the enemy target. All three sections are more capable in this mode. What? Really?
Yeah, see, there you go.
Why? That thing doesn't have nacelles, though. Yeah, the saucer doesn't have nacelles.
Yeah, okay, whatever. Right. Shut your mouth.
Another starship's class has similar capabilities. Go close to this.
Look, the point is that either these ships are more effective or less effective together. They're either more effective together or they're more effective apart. And if they're more effective apart, they should just be three ships. And if they're more effective together, they should be one ship. Because when you think about it, like, the systems that allow them to link up, that must take up a lot of space. Like, we're talking about more than just some hooks on the outside of the hull here. You know, we're talking about some very powerful, like, link, you know, coupling systems that are also, they also structurally weaken the ship to do that.
True.
So you are giving up, you are putting a large amount of resources. I'd rather just have three Defiant class ships than one of these, which is like three ships that look about the same size as a Defiant. They might actually be bigger, but they look about that size.
Well, here we go. I'll pose this question to our audience.
Yeah.
Tell us why, or what, and you can answer in the chat room if you want, we'll read them out. Because I definitely want to move on to other ships, I think. Because I think it's pretty clear that you just think the Prometheus was a bad idea.
I do.
Why you think the Prometheus is a good or bad starship design. You can email us at allthingsstrike@hotmail.com, or you can put it into the chat room if you'd like to, which is at through IRC, which you can connect through your favorite IRC client if you want to, blah, 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 blah.
Right. Okay, so anyway, we're moving on.
Or really any ship that we talk about today at all.
Yeah, but really, the Prometheus is because Bob knows he's losing, and he wants help. He's calling for reinforcements.
Well, I do, because... Well,
he's trying to split himself into three and come at me from different directions.
it's quite possible that maybe they just thought about, you know, having a ship that splits into three and coming from different angles, but didn't delve into it far enough to cover a lot of the questions and concerns you have about the ship. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's why I'm posing it to the audience. You know, it's like, I actually hate the way the Prometheus looks myself, personally.
First of all, I wish they would stop calling it a saucer if it's not saucer-shaped.
The pie trowel?
The spade?
The spade. The spade section.
The trapezoid? I don't know.
Prometheus is kind of like Voltron, says Jeff Dem.
Yeah, that's accurate. And Voltron is from, like, what, like an 80s like cartoon for little kids.
Yeah.
Voltron was never supposed to make sense.
Little kids necessarily. I don't really know about that.
I don't know. I never actually watched that show. I don't really know a whole lot about Voltron. Or is Voltron the Power Rangers thing?
Voltron is a pseudo Power Rangers thing, I would think. Okay. Voltron, I think, predated Power Rangers. But one thing that happens with a lot of Japanese animation when it comes over to the States is that it gets kidified just because everyone looks at it and says, oh, that's a cartoon, it's hand-drawn, it's for kids.
Sure.
So, again, I've never seen Voltron like the original Japanese, if there was an original Japanese. I don't know enough about Voltron, necessarily, or who the target audience was. But I do know it was definitely targeted for kids here in the States. But, anyway... Voltron is where you had all the lion cat things that then hooked up into the larger robot.
Okay, so it's... Well, I always thought of that as Power Rangers. I
mean, if we go with that logic, why doesn't Starfleet actually build all the ships to be able to couple with each other so it can build a super ship?
Well, see...
Just have, like, galaxy classes and stuck together.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Prometheus in there.
You know, it's the same... They do the same thing in Power Rangers.
Oh, yeah, you can have, like, the Galaxy X Dreadnoughts in the arms so they shoot their phaser lances.
Oh, my goodness.
I like where this is going.
I don't... Let's move on to the Galaxy Class.
Okay, the Galaxy Class.
This conversation can only get stupider. Look what you've done,
I'm seriously envisioning this. So, like, this, like, robot ship in space with the Galaxy X's on, like, its hand going, boil, boil, from its fist, kind of like Iron Man style.
Oh, my goodness.
I apologize, everybody. That was dumb.
I don't think you're really sorry, Bob. I think you're sorry you got caught. Anyway, so Galaxy Class.
The Galaxy Class, yes. Very lovely lines.
Sort of. I actually have a thing about the Galaxy Class. I feel like at some point, in maybe about mid-second season of TNG, they changed the Galaxy Class a little bit. Because this is like, when I go back and watch the early episodes now, I think, darn, that saucer section is bulbous. And, like, it just looks really, really big. Like, and it's kind of fat-looking, and I'm just like, ugh, that looks kind of out of proportion with the rest of the ship. But then, later on in TNG, I notice it doesn't have that problem. And I feel like there was a change made. Maybe it wasn't even a change to the model. Maybe it was just a change in the way they moved the camera that made the saucer section look a little
There are definitely angles at which the camera angles that the Galaxy looks a lot better than it does in others.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. Like that particular one where it looks like you're looking, for me anyway, when you're looking at the ship and if you're positioned in a way so that you're off the ship's starboard bow, you're looking at it. I don't like that angle because it definitely does make the saucer section look like giant in comparison to the rest of the ship and looks out of proportion. However, if you come at it from like a top-down angle, it actually doesn't look too bad.
No, I mean, I like the Galaxy Class. I just think that it looks better in later TNG, and I don't know if that's because they changed the model or because they just learned how to film it right, but it looks better. Mm-hmm. This is something that I've noticed.
Yeah. What do you think about that big neck?
I'm not crazy about the neck. I'm not crazy about the saucer section separating at all, personally. Because it's... Like, anything that links back to the Enterprise having children on it annoys me. And, like, you know, theoretically, part of the saucer section's purpose is to evacuate the civilians and the children.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, okay, I can see having civilian personnel on the ship. The ship is, like, the size of a small city. Like, I could see that you might need some people who are not in Starfleet, and like maybe for you know, you'd let Starfleet personnel bring their spouses on board as long as their spouses performed a useful role. But there should not be children on this ship, okay? This is the ship that is constantly going into the most dangerous phenomena you could possibly find. You know, when things get real, Starfleet sends in the Enterprise. You do not want children on that ship.
Yeah.
They you know, they die. Just to get it out there. And it's, you know, it's one thing to send a Starfleet officer who was trained for it, or an adult civilian who knew what they were getting into. But personally, I think it's reprehensible that you would send children into that kind of danger.
Mm-hmm.
And the children don't know. They didn't make that choice. They're just going where they think they're supposed to go. And, like, you know, okay, maybe this will make it harder for Starfleet officers serving on Galaxy-class ships to have families. I'm okay with that. I will take that as an acceptable trade. I'm not a huge fan of the giant neck, just for reference. But, I mean, I like it okay. And when there was, like, one, like, weird kit bash that they did where, like, one of the debris ships you see floating at Wolf 359 is basically a Galaxy-class without the neck. Like, not even a Nebula class.
You're talking about the New Orleans.
Yeah, I think so. It's like a Galaxy class. They just smoosh the neck right out of it. And it looks really goofy.
Uh-huh.
But maybe that's just because I'm used to the way the Galaxy looks. And it's, you know, it does have that nice, like, the, you know, that nice grace to it.
Great lines to it. And it was a really well-designed ship artistically, I think. And it was also really nice to see this evolution in Starship design from TOS to... Through TMP, mind you, which is the motion picture stuff, all the way to TNG, which it's definitely the look has changed. The things have technologically advanced. I mean, well, not only in special effects, but, you know, also within, you know, the galaxy.
In the universe, yeah.
Exactly. This was a huge ship, 42 decks. I don't think there's another ship out there in Starfleet right now that is that big. I mean, except for the JJ Prize.
Really?
Have you seen any of the, like, ship comparison stuff?
Oh, well, I mean, the JJ Enterprise is definitely way bigger on the inside than it looks on the outside, based on, like, Doctor Who technology.
Well, because you have, like, pixel counters, right, out there that are counting pixels and whatnot for the ship and how big it's supposed to be. And maybe I can find a quick link for you on that. And JJ Enterprise size comparison. The new Enterprise design, maybe. We'll do an image search is what I'll do.
Well, I mean...
But if you look at it... Yeah, here we go.
Oh, wow.
So, Constitution, Refit, Enterprise, Sovereign, new Enterprise again.
In, like... Yeah, but that's, like...
That is huge!
Yeah, but I don't think that's how big it's supposed to be. I think that's just, like, it's pixel count. Right?
Yeah, there's a link for everybody in the chat room.
That's
which
a long-ass link.
Well, it's a Google image link, what can I say? But, yeah, so... Yeah, I don't know how much you want to take into account or whatnot, or if you want to call it quote-unquote faithful to Trek just because the size of the Enterprise is variable between 762 to 914 meters, which is giant.
Like, did they ever say it was that long? I have to admit I'm confused how they're arriving at this size.
Well, this isn't official from the, like, Bad Robot or anything like that. Like, I don't think this is a tech manual thing at all. These are people who've like seen the movie, then they went out and bought the DVD and are sitting there with the image screen cap, counting the pixels, and then doing the math for how tall a person is, how big shuttlecraft are, and figuring out how big the Enterprise is. I think that there isn't actually a solid number that people have been able to come to yet on the Enterprise because the shots are variable for how big stuff is.
Well, that's a goof. That's a little different. That's not like... we made this ship super huge. That's just like, you know, they didn't pay too much attention to it. One thing that
I which is unfortunate, I think.
Yeah.
But.
One thing that I didn't really like the new Enterprise in that it's... like, I liked the new Enterprise's saucer and its drive section fine. I thought its nacelles were a little too big. And I did think that the shuttle bay is too big. Like, the shuttle bay looks like it takes up almost the entire drive section in some shots.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's a goof. I don't think that's intentional. And I also... I'm not a huge fan of the deflector dish being an actual dish. I liked it more when it was...
It
like,
kind of integrated into the hull.
Yeah, when it was part of the hull and, you know, something future-y looking.
It kind of actually protected.
Yeah. Just having an actual dish hanging out there seemed a little bit low rent to me. as for other ships that I do really like, I'm a huge fan of the Borg cube. Not so much of the...
It's just the cube.
The cube. I like the cube. I'm not a huge fan of the sphere. I feel like they were reaching a little bit with that one. They were like, well, you know, guys, the Borg cube is a geometric shape, so their other ships must also be geometric shapes. But, like, I don't really see why the smaller Borg ship is not just a smaller cube. Like, the whole point of the cube is that it like, scales up perfectly, and the Borg technology is just, like, completely decentralized and... arranged in this geometric pattern. I don't really see the point of making it a sphere. And then they, like, introduce, like...
I think that's more for the audience's benefit, to indicate size, you know, the relative power of each vessel.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
I mean, because... And this was kind of established in First Contact, where the sphere is definitely a lot smaller than the cube.
Yes.
And then
it can fit inside a cube.
And then we have the Borg milk bone from Voyager.
Oh, that, you mean, the capsule?
Yeah.
Like the Borg capsule ship?
Yeah, which is even smaller than that. It's kind of like a scout vessel, you know. So it was not to confuse the audience that... I think it was a move to not confuse the audience on what the encounter level, or the power level of the encounter is supposed to be.
Sure.
Know? Like, you know, CR rating of 33 for cube, CR of 12 for sphere, I don't know. for those that are familiar with child ratings.
what have you done, Bob?
I'm throwing words out there, is what I'm doing.
Yeah, I mean, and we already know that I really love the Ambassador class. Talking about some not Starfleet ships, I really liked the Romulan Warbird from TOS.
You mean the Bird of Prey?
Whatever.
That was a Bird of Prey in TOS.
You can call it a Bird of Prey if you want.
It doesn't matter what I call it, or it's what everyone
else
calls
it. I was never a huge fan of the Klingon, the D7 cruiser.
Really? I like that one.
I mean, it's got this really long neck that I wasn't a huge fan of, and it's got like...
That's just one long torpedo tube.
It's got like, it looks like it's wearing a hat on like on the front part. It's like a ship wearing a hat, and I'm just like, No, sir.
I like the idea of a ship wearing a top hat. Man.
That's what it looks like. It looks like it's wearing a hat, and I'm not crazy about that idea.
I thought I like the D7 because it looks to me like it looks like a very functional ship to me.
You think so?
It's very functional. There's not a whole lot of form to it. I mean, it's literally I need guns that point forward, and I need engines, and that's what it is.
I suppose.
right? And is very phallic looking, right?
Yeah, there's that.
Right? I mean, we're talking about Klingon warriors here. And if you look at, you know, especially like in the military and such, like all the chevrons that people get on their uniform, I mean, look how those are designed, for instance, and what kind of shape they form.
Yeah. So, I know. I've
seen that. So there we go. trying to be as careful as I can with my words. But anyway, other ships. You thought the Bird of Prey was cool. Yeah. I thought the D7 was cool.
I mean,
the Bird of Prey is also kind of another functional ship.
Yeah, and I mean, like,
because it's got its engines on it, and it's got its, you know, kind of crew area with its, you know, main gun pointing forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's another very functional ship.
I do like the Klingon Bird of Prey, just because, but that, you know, it's a very iconic ship, the Klingon Bird of
Prey.
Yes,
originally supposed to be a Romulan ship.
Yeah, I've heard that. I was never super crazy about the Vorcha class, but that might just be because the Vorcha class has never really been shown to be all that cool. Usually we see Vorcha classes either not doing anything or getting blown up. Very rarely have we seen a Vorcha class, like, actually, like, you know, kick some butt. And so that might be just a reaction to that. But, like, visually, I don't know, I was never a huge fan. I did like...
Well, that was, I think, supposed to be another showing that things have technologically progressed.
Right.
As we make the jump from TOS to TNG. Just as we go from the Constitution class being the main ship to the Galaxy class being the main ship, which the Galaxy class is a lot bigger than the Constitution.
I always wish we had seen more galaxies in TNG. Like, we saw so few galaxies. I wanted there to be...
We only saw one other one.
Yeah, the Yamato.
I wanted to see
a couple of others.
You get to see a few of them in DS9.
Yeah, you do, which is one of the reasons why I like DS9. Oh, speaking of DS9, what the heck is up with all those Miranda-class ships? Like, we had this discussion on, you had this discussion on Podcast UGC, where we were just talking about, like, how there's all these Miranda-class ships hanging out in the Dominion War. And I was like, that was the thing that weirded me out, was that there were these Miranda-class ships, but for some reason there were never any Constitution or Ambassador-class ships. And it's like, why not? You've got the models. Are you not allowed to use them for some reason? maybe because was Paramount and CBS two different things by then? I don't think so. I think they were the same thing.
Well, CBS wasn't involved with DS9, I don't think, were they?
Well, I'm just saying it was just one company that owned all of Star Trek at that point, right? So it wouldn't have been like an issue for using the movies version of the Enterprise for, you know, of the Constitution class for DS9. I mean,
I think it might have come down to money, is what it was. Because by the time we see a lot of Miranda classes pop up, if I know kind of where in the series you're talking about here, by the time we start seeing a lot of ships pop up, we've changed the CGI at that point, right?
Yeah.
And this is still mid-90s that we're talking about here, mid-90s CGI, which is expensive to do, right? So if you have artists sitting down, it's going to cost a lot more to have several artists come up with several different CGI renderings of ships than it is to just have a few artists come up with a couple of renderings of a couple different ships.
Yeah.
That way you can just copy-paste it a bunch of times.
Yeah, and I have a feeling...
In a case like the Miranda or the Excelsior.
I have a feeling that they didn't use the movies, like the movies era Constitution class, because I think that would have been a little too iconic. It would have, like... Because, you know, you're supposed to be watching the Defiant during most of those battle sequences.
True.
And if we'd seen, like, you know, a ship that, for all intents and purposes, we assume is the Enterprise, because that's the only, you know, Constitution-class refit we've ever seen.
Yep.
It's like, what's the Enterprise doing in that background shot? Like, you know, we wouldn't be looking at the Defiant anymore. And I think, so I can understand why they didn't do that. I'm just bitter that there were no Ambassador class. I will always be bitter about that. I will never get over it.
Yeah, well.
Let's see. I'm not sure if there are what other ships there are. Like, there's a lot of... I like the Galor class, but I don't like the Keldon from the Cardassians. Because, like, the Keldon just struck me as being really lazy. It was just like, all right, guys, we've got this Galor. We're going to make it a little fatter. And now it's a Keldon. And it's like, oh, all right, sure, why not? Whereas, like, you'll notice the Hideki, which I do like, is actually a different ship. Like,
yeah,
the Hideki
it's a
class
smaller
is a smaller scout ship. It's not just a miniaturized, Galor, or like the
Galor
front,
Jr.
or the front section of a Galor. It's like an actual different ship. Whereas the...
That would have been funny if they just hacked a Galor in half.
Yeah, this is a Hideki. It's just half of a Galor. That would have been, I don't know, that would have been an interesting choice.
It looked like a taco flying through space.
All right.
Cool.
Well, Chris, I hope that satisfies your email. That was definitely fun for us.
All right. So, you want to go to music break?
I'm thinking it's time for some music.
Yeah, a little music.
You're listening to the podcast and archive of all things Trek. The music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music breaks, please tune in live, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern, only on Trek Radio.
And welcome back to All Things Trek here on TrekRadio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
And everything positive does make Oren sneeze.
That's a chat room reference for anyone who isn't currently looking at the chat room.
Yeah. Although, which is a comment that, maybe they'd like to hear some positive things, which, unfortunately, Oren is allergic to positive things.
I think we had one episode where I had some positive things to say.
I'd buy that for $1.
Maybe one or two. No, but I mean, I thought I mentioned some ships I liked. I thought I did. I thought I said I liked the Galaxy class and that I liked the Galore.
Well, yeah, but you immediately followed up with why you think that that has some dumb decisions in it.
You know, that's actually interesting. I had this thing where a contract I did when I was at Evergreen for like 4 credits or so.
Evergreen College, right?
Yeah, Evergreen College. I did like this little minor independent contract where I reviewed a bunch of sci-fi episodes of different shows and like said why they worked and didn't work, and it is so much easier to review bad episodes because like you can only say something is good so many different ways. It's very hard to often explain why it's good, but it's so easy to explain why things are bad. Like, you know, you can go into so much detail, but like when you're trying to say why something is good, it's like, well, I liked it, it's cool. Although, the exception to that was my War Stories review for Firefly was, like, 15 pages. Because everything in that episode is connected. You can't, like, leave any of it out.
Yep.
But anyway, that aside. So, I think...
If you'd like to interact with the show,
yes,
there's a few ways you can do it. You can send us an email at allthingstrek@hotmail.com. Then there's also our Twitter. What is it, Oren? What's our Twitter?
Our Twitter is allthingstrek.
All right, cool. Right on. That's our Twitter. And there's also the IRC chat room, which, if you don't have your own IRC client for which to connect to it, or you don't have Star Trek Online, you can go to the community tab and go to IRC chat room. There will be prompted to enter a name, and you just click connect, and bam, you'll be in our chat room.
Yeah.
Where you too can also wonder why Oren is allergic to positive things.
I have my reasons.
Hives are among them, apparently.
All right,
so we have children that we want to talk about, right?
We do, but wait, hold on. Before that, we're doing something pretty cool next week.
Yes, we are.
Next week, Saturday, is the anniversary of The Wrath of Khan.
The 30th anniversary of The Wrath of Khan.
And so we are having as guests on our show Terry Lynn and Gettysburg 7 over from the G&T show.
Yep.
And we'll probably be talking about, like, I don't know,
The Wrath of Khan.
Star Trek 4, I was going to say, the Whales movie.
Oh, you failed this.
But we'll talk about something. And it'll probably be The Wrath of Khan.
Yep.
Just for reference.
Yep.
So anyway, please join us for that. It'll be a lot of fun. So, in respect to being asked for more positive things, I think we should start off our discussion about children, which was our main topic for today, but then we got asked about spaceships, and we got a little carried away.
Yeah, that was actually going to be our secondary topic.
Yeah, but then we did things in reverse.
We did.
You know, and you too, folks, can completely rearrange our show schedule if you send us emails.
See, it's an interactive show.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a positive thing, right?
So, we're just going to start...
You're breaking out Hives, Oren.
Uh-oh. So just starting off with two of the kids in Star Trek that I really liked were Jake and Nog from Deep Space Nine. Okay. And if you listen to the show a lot, you've probably figured out that I really love Deep Space Nine. I think Deep Space Nine to me is not only the best Star Trek show, it's probably, in my opinion, the best finished show that I've ever seen. Like, finished. I'll make that qualifier. Like, I really like...
Define finish, sir.
A show that ran for its full length and then concluded. Like, there are a lot of really good shows that were canceled and we'll never know how good they could have been. Like, Firefly, for example, is a really good show, but, you know, it was really good for 14 episodes. Mm. We have no idea if Firefly would have stayed good if it had been on the air for 5 seasons.
Right.
There are a lot of shows that start off good and then go downhill, like Heroes, for example. And so, just as a whole, looking at shows that I've seen that actually went all the way to their conclusion, I think Deep Space Nine is my favorite.
Okay.
Like, just straight up. But anyway, Jake and Nog are really interesting characters, and I know some people in the beginning, like, don't like them for one reason or another. You know, sometimes people say they can be annoying, and it's true, they can to an extent, but, like, they're supposed to be annoying because they're little kids, and kids can be annoying sometimes. This is the thing about kids. It's like It's like, you know, Wesley is annoying, but, like, the show isn't really... the you know, he's not supposed to be annoying. He's just written like that. whereas Jake and Nog, when they're being annoying, they're supposed to be annoying, and the other characters react appropriately. And, of course, they also have, like, this, you know, this friendship that crosses cultures, which I really like. Nog just has great development over the course of the show.
Yep.
And it becomes a Starfleet officer, but, like, in a way that doesn't make me feel like the show is trying to tell me that everyone in the universe should become a Starfleet officer, because being a Starfleet officer is so much cooler than anything else you could possibly be. And, like, you know, I like that when he becomes a Starfleet officer, he doesn't just give up his Ferengi heritage. He's still a Ferengi, and he still yep. cares about his Ferengi cultural values, but he learns to integrate the two. And I think that's an inspiration that I think we could do with more of in the real world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And with Jake, I really like that Jake is a character who doesn't join Starfleet, you know, because we've hardly seen any characters who are not in Starfleet, which is actually one of the reasons why I like Sisko's dad, for the same reason.
Admiral Cartwright?
Yeah, except, barring that he's totally Admiral Cartwright. I like Jake for the fact that he doesn't want to be in Starfleet. I sympathize with Jake because I also want to be a writer, although Jake is really lazy sometimes. This is a problem that I have with Jake, is that he's sometimes comes across as a reason why the Federation wouldn't work. You know, he doesn't really have to do anything. He just kind of lounges around most of the time and will sometimes write when the inspiration takes him. And it's like, you know, I feel like he could maybe be working a little harder.
Well, that's because he's not working to feed himself, though.
Well, see, that's the thing.
His basic needs are taken care of.
Well, my theory on Jake is actually that, like, Jake is growing up on a Bajoran space station, right?
Right.
But he's also the son of the station commander. So, like you said, he doesn't have any necessities that aren't being met. But if he was growing up back in a Federation planet, I'm fairly certain part of his schooling, and part of, like, the schooling of most Federation kids is, like, yes, your basic necessities are met, but this is why you should continue to achieve anyway. And, like, their curriculum and their early schooling is set up to teach them the values of self-improvement and working to make things better, even though you don't have to in order to survive.
Yeah.
But because Jake doesn't have that, because he doesn't go to a formal Federation school, his school is taught by someone who thought it might be fun to be a teacher. Because, you know, being a teacher is really easy. Like, you can just pick it up. And, like, he's going to school with a bunch of people who are not from the Federation. He doesn't have that same like drive instilled in him, but he also doesn't have to work for anything. So that's sort of my internal logic for why Jake sometimes comes across as being really lazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like Jake. I especially like Jake in the later seasons, and I like watching Jake grow up. Like, it's really cool that I can't remember. Cyric Lofton, I think is his name. It's the actor's name. He is a
little
kid.
I'm not sure you say it that way, but yeah.
But like, he is a little kid when the show starts. And by the time the show ends, he's, like, become an adult, and we see him age. Although, I was actually really surprised to find out that Jake is supposed to be, like, 14 or 15 when the show starts. I thought he was much younger.
I thought he was, like, 12.
No, he's 14.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
No, Jake is 15. Cyric Lofton is 14.
Okay.
Which I didn't realize. I thought they were supposed to be, you know, I thought they were supposed to be younger than that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, Nog's actor is an adult when the show starts. I don't remember his name off the top of my head. But you obviously can't tell because of all
the actor's
makeup.
Name?
Yeah, the actor's
Aaron Eisenberg.
Name. Aaron Eisenberg, yeah. You can't tell because he has all the makeup on.
Uh-huh.
So those are two kids that I really, really like. And I think they do a really good job in the show. Although, one thing, and, you know, we were talking about Star Trek, we were talking about Memory Alpha earlier, and I really like Memory Alpha. But Memory Alpha, if anyone related to Memory Alpha is listening to this, why is it when I type Jake in the search bar, Jake Potts and Jake Trapper come up before Jake Sisko? Come on, guys. What do you think the chances are that when I type in Jake, I am looking for, like, two minor characters who were in one episode each, or I'm looking for Jake Sisko? What do you think the odds on that are? So there's that.
Yeah, I agree with you definitely on both those characters and how we see them in DS9. You know, it's great to see them grow up and to see how they take two, I guess you could say, very divergent paths. I mean, because, mm-hmm. You know, typically, I mean, how we would see it probably unfold in TNG is we would see the human go off and join Starfleet, and then the alien would be kind of more the lazy one, trying to aspire to what the human is.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Whereas DS9 has not done that and had it to where the alien, in this case, which is Nog, actually joined Starfleet because he doesn't want to end up like his dad, right? I think that was his main motivator that he said to Sisko was because I don't want to end up like my dad, which is, you know, working for my uncle and, you know, just tending bar. I mean, he actually, I think he was an engineer at that point, actually, on the station.
Junior. That was before then.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
He, Nog expressed a desire to go to Starfleet Academy before Rom, realized that working at his father's bar was, or looking at Quark's bar was just not doing it.
Yeah, Nog has definitely recognized that things can be better. He doesn't want to.
Nog realized that in Ferengi society, the only skill that is valued and that really gets you anywhere is business skill. And Nog is like, well, my dad has this, you know, incredible gift with machines, but that gift isn't useful because he doesn't have business skills.
Yeah.
So he just gets exploited for his gift with machines.
Yep.
And that, you know, I thought that was a very powerful moment, the way Nog, Aaron Eisenberg, you said was the actor's name, the way he delivered those lines. Just that whole thing is really good.
Mm-hmm.
And another kid in Star Trek that I actually really liked, I like Naomi Wildman, I have to say. I thought it was really? Really, I thought it was really goofy.
Something out of Voyager you like, eh?
I like some things out of Voyager. I liked Naomi Wildman. I thought it was really goofy that she was the kid with the invisible mother. Because, her mom...
We say that only because we don't see a whole lot of Samantha Wildman.
No. Like, we see way less of her after Naomi is born.
Yes.
We see her significantly more often before then.
Yep.
Also, she had, the longest gestation period in the history of sentient races, but whatever.
Well, it was early on in season one that she told the captain, hey, I'm pregnant, and then when was Naomi born?
Like, halfway through season two.
Huh.
So, she has, an 18-month gestation period.
She's not entirely human.
No, she's not.
I mean, Naomi isn't entirely human.
But she's
human.
Being birthed out of a human.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I'm not a doctor. I'm a podcaster. You know, I... You know, it's alien stuff. It's alien physiology that we're dealing with at this point. Maybe Katarian, I think, was with the other...
Whatever.
With the father was.
She's got the horns.
Yeah, so maybe that was just a... You know, maybe that's just how long it takes for Katarian children to...
Yeah, but I mean, I liked Naomi Wildman. I thought that she was... I mean, first of all, she was something that I'd always wanted on Voyager, which was, non-A-cast members who were actually developed and cool.
More B-cast members, if you will.
Yeah, more B-cast, more secondary characters. That's just... And CB in the chat room, maybe that's possible, is that she did also grow up fairly quickly. She looks... I haven't done the math yet, but I'm fairly certain she can't be as old as she's portrayed in Voyager.
Because she's about six or seven or so by that time, isn't she, at the end of the series?
I think she's older than
portrayed
that.
Portrayed to be that? Really?
I think she's older. She's portrayed... she should be about five or six by the end of the show, but I think she's supposed to be older than that. Just from my experience interacting with 5- and 6-year-olds...
I really want to call it the Alexander effect.
Yeah, well... No one ages as weirdly as Alexander. He ages like a freaking dog. It's like, shows up, is like 2, and then like is like 18 in the course of about 9 years. Something like, I don't know. I haven't double-checked this, but actually someone did the math and said that Worf can't be Alexander's father because Alexander is too old. And I haven't double-checked that, which I really should have for this podcast. That would have been funny. I'll double-check that math. But anyway, I feel Naomi Wildman was a breath of fresh air in a way that, oddly, I didn't think Seven of Nine was. I like Seven of Nine to an extent, but Naomi Wildman just seemed to me to be a lot... Just something different that Voyager had not done before. And I guess... I'm having a hard time explaining this in words because, technically, Seven of Nine was different too, and they never had that either. But I just felt way more interested in Naomi Wildman than I did in Seven of Nine, probably because Naomi Wildman wasn't dressing in a cat suit.
True, she had coveralls, I remember.
She had clothes.
Yeah,
she had actual clothes, and she wasn't wearing earth tones, which is Star Trek's default when you're a civilian is wear earth tones.
Oh, she had a lot of autumn colors, I remember. Had some browns and orange and red.
Yeah, but she had variety. She wasn't always dressed in the same thing.
Yeah.
And also, maybe just that the child actress was very good. I don't know. I liked that character. This is actually something that Kathy wanted me to bring up.
Your mom?
Yeah, she wanted me to bring up Seven of Nine as a child. Because you can, I can see how you could look at it that way. I mean, Seven of Nine was...
Well, she was assimilated as a child. Right. She was like 8 years old or something.
She was assimilated as a child. But then, and then she was free as an adult. But you could ask the question, is she an adult mentally? Because, like, she hasn't really been developing those years as a born drone. Like, it's a question of, like, you know, does being a Borg drone for those years, like, you know, give her the emotional and, like, mental maturity to be considered an adult? It must, you know, or is it more like, or is it like if you put someone in a coma and let their body grow for, you know, for 20 years and then woke them up, would they be an adult? And, you know, even though their mind is the same as it was when they were six.
Well, Seven still had the assimilation of knowledge from the collective. So she was...
So she knew a lot.
When she was released from, you know, the collective, if you will, just by being separated for so long. Because, you know, when you separate drones, they just...
This isn't something I can blame Voyager for. This is Next Generation's fault. Where they were like, if you just separate a drone from the collective for long enough, they'll become an individual again. But, like, Voyager really pressed it home.
Yeah, so, she had a lot of knowledge still. So it wasn't like she was put in a coma, and then nothing happened for, like, 20 years. And then she woke up and, you know, literally just knows whatever she knew 20 years ago. She had a lot of book smart. She was a very book smart individual when she comes back into being human. I think I would actually characterize it that way, actually, is that she is book smart versus street smart, but to such an extreme that she can't function, you know, very well in a social environment.
Yeah, see, the thing about it, and the reason why I don't agree with this idea that Seven of Nine should be considered, like, a child, is that one of the things that I think really determines if you're a child or not is your ability to, like, foresee consequences of your actions. And your ability to understand those consequences. Seven of Nine had no problem understanding the consequences of her actions. Sometimes she didn't care.
yeah.
But she clearly had judgment. She could clearly make, like, you know, calls based on what was going on around her. Her problem was that she didn't have social skills. And you could get that same thing by, like, you know, having someone who lived in the forest for 15 years.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have social skills either, but they would still be an adult.
They still have practical knowledge about things still.
Right. And, like, so that's why I don't really think it works. And the reason why my mom likes this theory is because she says it makes Janeway's actions and her whole attitude towards Seven seem make much more sense, because it's like a maternalistic relationship as opposed to just Janeway just telling Seven what to do, despite what, and Seven having no say in the matter. Which I can understand
partly,
that idea.
Partly because it's just the social development that we're looking after here. CB in the chat room. See, you can do positive. Yeah, you're breaking out something fierce right now. But that was only partly. I mean, really, a lot of the social development for Seven really kind of stemmed from the Doctor later on, more so than it did Janeway.
Which I do love. Because of its hilarity, the Doctor teaching Seven to be human.
Yeah, the hologram, just like the android teaching the blind man to paint.
Well, you know, David's a great painter.
Yeah, he is. But yeah, Janeway, I don't think really. In kind of a way, I think Janeway was using Seven more as a tool, and Ked put that to the side for more practical concerns on her end, and that's kind of where the Doctor picks up all the time. I mean, the Doctor also had feelings for Seven later on, right?
So. Yeah. See, I mean, my thing about Seven is that part of it is just that I cannot conceive of Seven as a child and then imagine what Seven dresses like. Because I'm just like, if I consider Seven of Nine to be a child and then I think of the clothes they put her in, it's just like, oh, no, everything is wrong. Red alert in my brain. Everything out.
Let me throw one at you.
Yeah. Throw it. I got
and I want to move away from Voyager. Away from Seven of Nine. Unless you have more that you want to talk about Voyager.
We can come back.
Okay. Well, we'll discuss more. I actually have one for Enterprise.
This is different Voyager kids. I want to talk about Ichab and the Borg kids.
Okay, let's go. Let's move on to those, though. But I have something for Enterprise later on.
I don't remember there being any kids in Enterprise.
Well, this is going to be part of my point. But anyway.
All right.
Ichab and them.
Okay, well, Ichab,
First off, these are all adolescent Borg that were taken off of a cube because all the adult Borg were dead.
Yeah.
Right. And they were trying to figure out how to run the cube and whatnot, and they couldn't do it very well.
Right.
Right, and then they're taken off the cube, and then they're de-assimilated.
De-assimilated. But, like, Ichab, I liked Ichab to an extent. Sometimes he was a little flat. But I liked him, and I thought he and Seven had an interesting relationship. I was a little... The other Borg kids weren't really around a whole lot. Like, they left pretty quickly after they were, you know...
Well, they were taken back to their respective cultures, I think, right? As they ran into them.
Because, and I understand why they did that. You know,
Ichab was, but there was some...
No, Ichab something, stayed. Ichab stayed.
Well, Ichab stayed, but they were going to give him back to whatever culture it was, but...
But then they found out that his people wanted to use him as a virus bomb.
Yeah.
And they were like, no, sir.
no, sir. Yeah.
But I mean, I liked Ichab to an extent. I thought Ichab, like... worked fairly well as a former drone. I liked him a little bit. You know, I'll be honest. I'm just going to say it. I liked him a little bit more than I liked Seven. Seven always, if only because Seven kind of took over the show when she showed up, and like everything was about Seven. I feel like Ichab was a more grounded character, and sometimes he didn't have quite. And Ichab's actor didn't have quite the presence that Jeri Ryan's has. Jeri Ryan's a very good actress, just straight up. And part of the reason. Part of the reason I like Seven at all is because Jeri Ryan's really brings the point home. Whereas the guy playing Ichab just didn't have the same presence. But Ichab as a character, I think, works a little bit better. If only because he was more... I liked his thing because he had the same sort of social ignorance that Seven did, even though he hadn't been assimilated for nearly as long. But he manifested as more of like being hesitant, not being sure what to do. Whereas Seven was very, like, I would say very angry, almost. It was like, she manifested her lack of social skills as, like, lashing out at everyone around her. Which, I mean, you could definitely say makes sense, considering... But, like, I mean, they both have very traumatic assimilation stories. It may have something to do with Seven just being in the collective for longer. But overall, I liked each of them, and I liked his relationship to Seven.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other Borg kids, it's hard to comment on because they weren't around very much.
Yeah.
Of course, they, you know, they let him hang out with Neelix, which is always a mistake.
What I find interesting about Ichab is that as soon as he's all dissimulated and stuff, he instantly wants to start being the crew. He wants to start in Starfleet. Like, that becomes his ambition.
Right. That's not instant. That takes a little while. Like, he wants to join Starfleet a little bit later. Like... He's been with the crew for a little bit before he decides he wants to join Starfleet.
I don't remember it being that long, because I remember that he very much wanted to start taking on duties on the ship, and that, well, that developed into wanting to join Starfleet, sure, but he very much wanted to be a part of the ship and the collective that is Voyager, if you will.
Right.
Right, because he didn't know anything else but the Borg, right?
Well, sort of. That was the thing about Ichab that always weirded me out, was that he hadn't been assimilated that long. Like, he was assimilated when he was what? Like, not that much younger than when they found him. And then his ship...
Well, they were all still in maturation chambers or something like that, right?
So was he assimilated as a little kid and then fast-grown into being a teenager?
Mm-hmm.
Was that how it worked?
I don't know. I recall specifically because the reason that the kids were still there and not dead is because the chambers that they were in were protected in isolated environments while they grew and matured.
Right, I remember that.
So...
But I always got the impression that Ichab hadn't been assimilated for very long.
So he didn't... Maybe he just didn't have any experience at all, period. Maybe he is truly a child.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was thinking might be a possibility, is that Ichab was assimilated as, like, a very young child, and then he was fast grown into the body of a teenager, which would be really disorienting. Like, you know, you've been assimilated, right? And then unassimilated, and that's all really traumatic. But then now suddenly, like, you're trying to line up your... You weren't assimilated for very long, so you didn't have the thing that Seven had of being able to absorb all the Borg knowledge. And you're trying to remember your memories from before you were assimilated, and you're like, I was like 3 feet shorter. And also, I thought girls had cooties. That would be really weird. So I don't know that, like, I think that, well, and I think that Void, that Ichab wanted to join Starfleet made a lot of sense, because, I mean, what else are you going to do on Voyager? Voyager is a ship that, like, unless you're spending all day in the holodeck, if you're not doing a job on the ship, there's really very little to do.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, obviously, what's her name? Naomi, she was basically being homeschooled, so she had a lot of stuff to learn, but because Ichab...
By Neelix.
Yeah, my Neelix. But because Icheb had like all of this knowledge imparted to him by the Borg, he didn't really need to do that. He didn't need to learn to read or, you know, or learn basic geometry. Uh-huh. He knew all that stuff. So it's like, really, if you're Icheb and you're thinking about it, it's like, all right, well, my choices are that I can either just laze about all day and, like, you know, replicate grapes and then peel them, or I could join the crew. Those are really the two things you have to do on Voyager. And uh-huh. So it makes perfect sense to me that he would want to join Starfleet.
Yeah.
I think he would have, you know, I thought that story. All right, so you go ahead. Tell me your Enterprise thing, because I'm curious.
Porthos.
Oh, my God. Porthos? What?
Being taken care of.
Explain this to me.
Porthos. No function
on the
ship.
He's a dog. He's not a child. He's an animal.
Yeah, but it's very much the captain's child, yes?
Oh, my goodness. This is not where I thought this conversation... I thought this was going. Porthos.
So my next one would be like Hoshi, but that would be too obvious.
I guess you could argue that he fulfills some of the same roles. He certainly... The amount of drama they have building up over Porthos being sick in Dear Doctor... is certainly something I would associate more with a child than with a dog. But that's... I don't know what else I can say about this. It's Porthos. I mean, whatever. He's a dog.
Like I said, I just wanted to throw it at you and see what your reaction was. I got exactly what I wanted.
Yeah, you did. You just threw me completely for a loop.
Like I said, it was Hoshi. Oh! But anyway...
Are there any other kids in Enterprise? Not that I can think of.
What about Terra Nova? I mean, they all very much acted kind of like children.
Yeah, yeah, they
I mean,
did.
The way they spoke, because they didn't have any good... I mean, as kind of, I think, silly as it was, because the colony had only been dark for, what, 80 years or something?
Like a couple generations.
Yeah, it wasn't very long, and there was just this amazing regression of understanding and technology.
Well, I mean, wasn't the implication of Terra Nova that, like, everyone except the kids died from the original colony? So, you know, I mean, if you have a bunch of kids trying
to... how old were those kids, though? The way they talk and relate seems to me like... Either they have brain damage from what's happened...
From all the radiation?
Or they were very, very young. Very young. The Augments is also...
Oh, yeah, the Augments.
But still on Terra Nova... It seems to me like they probably all would have died in actuality if they were so young that their level of knowledge and understanding is what we see in Terra Nova.
Yeah, those
underground. They had to have been very, very young. That or the colonists weren't actually teaching them anything.
Well, I mean, those...
Yeah, it had like a poor schooling system, you know, in place.
Those tunnels were definitely not like, were definitely not... a cornucopia overflowing with food and water sources. So, yeah, that is a little weird. I don't know. They're definitely sort of treated like children, where, like, they just sort of talk about what are we going to do with them, and, like, not really... They're not really... You know, it's sort of... It's not like, hey, let's talk seriously about your future. It's like, how can we trick them into doing what we want?
Yeah.
And, you know, they both, you know, supposedly they have, the characters have their best interests at heart, but they're clearly not really, they clearly don't see them as being capable of deciding their own future, or at least Archer doesn't.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know, maybe that's a fair point. But the Augments are an interesting idea. So for anyone who doesn't remember, in season 4 of Enterprise, they had a 3-part episode where they called back to the eugenics war, and they brought in the, Dr. Noonien Sung, like, the grandfather of the Noonien Sung we saw in TNG, or maybe the great-grandfather. I'm unclear how many generations are supposed to separate them. But he was played by Brent Spiner.
Yep.
And the plot was that a bunch of, he had stolen a bunch of bio-enhanced embryos from a research center and then grown them into kids.
Yep.
And then he'd been captured, and the kids had grown up like by themselves on this this colony that he created for them, and the Federation and Earth was never able to find them. I shouldn't say the Federation because it didn't exist.
Yeah, yet. Didn't exist yet.
But and then like the those augment kids start like running around and causing all kinds of problems, And among their augment powers is apparently the ability to be immune to bullets. Like, you know, I mean, I was really surprised when I was watching that episode, because, like, you know, we saw, like, Jack from Deep Space Nine was probably the most physically impressive of all the genetically engineered kids in that, or genetically engineered characters in that series. And he could, like, do a standing backflip, and that's pretty impressive. I mean, doing a standing backflip.
I wonder if that was actually the actor or a stunt guy.
I'm positive that was a stunt guy. Standing backflips are really hard. Like certain very high-level athletes can do it. But I never got the impression he was bulletproof.
Well, or those, energy weapons proof. They weren't augments, necessarily.
What's the difference? They were genetically engineered. And he was genetically engineered to be, like, physically superior as well as mental. He got the whole package. Whereas, like, Bashir only got the mental and hand-eye coordination stuff. I mean, I don't know. What's the difference between them?
That's actually an interesting question.
I'm pretty sure it's the same idea. Maybe not the same exact technology, but I was confused, and I didn't think that any amount of genetic...
Well, weren't the augments supposed to be an actual forced evolution of the species, whereas the others in DS9, like Chrysalis and, what was it, Statistical Probabilities, yeah. They were supposed to be just enhanced a bit, and that's and that went wrong?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the augments are the same thing. I think they are enhanced, like, embryos... you know, using genetic engineering. And I think... But, like, I mean, either way, they're both still basically humans, but with enhanced abilities. And I just don't think... It stretched my belief a little bit that the augments were able to perform the kinds of feats that they did and still be in human bodies. Like, at that point, I expected their skin to be made out of titanium. But, and that series of episodes is pretty good. Although, the thing about, and they're, like, they have a really interesting relationship with Dr. Sung, because he's their creator and their father figure.
And well, they call him father.
Yeah, but he's, like, at one point in the episode, he makes a really good point where, like, because everyone in that, one of the things about that episode that I can't stand is that whenever they, like, they argue with him all the time about genetic engineering and how it's wrong, and... Dr. Sung makes an actual argument, and all the other characters are just stating dogma at him. They're just like, you know, they're just like, hey, guy, he's like, but for all these reasons, genetic engineering is useful. And they're like, no, it's bad, it's so bad. And he's like, why is it bad? And they're like, well, one time the genetic wars happened. And it's like, yeah, I guess. Like, that's your one point, right? I mean, you don't really have anything else. You're just quoting dogma. And... By the end of the episode, I really wanted him to win, because he's like, he makes a point. He's like, maybe if I hadn't been in prison when they were little kids and growing, they wouldn't be violent psychopaths right now.
Nature versus nurture, right?
Yeah, and I'm like, yeah, I think he's probably right.
Uh huh.
Especially considering that it seems like they weren't all violent psychopaths. It was just that
it definitely seemed like Sung was much more of a scientist trying to prove a point. Before he was nabbed.
Right.
And then he turned into kind of...
Well, he wasn't like...
Or he had to turn to more illegal methods for getting what he needed done. Like, for instance, when they go to the Orion slave trading complex, for instance.
But, like, you know, for example, you see, like, there are the two main... the two main augments that you see. You see the lady and the guy. I don't remember their names. But the guy is the leader and the lady is, like, his second.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy is really violent. He's like, we are going to kill everyone who's not an augment. We're going to virus bomb this planet. And the lady is like, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we shouldn't be violent psychopaths.
Why can't we just go do our own thing, guys?
And it seems to me that what that is, that dynamic said to me, wasn't that, oh no, these augments are like predisposed to being violent psychopaths. What it said is that when you put a bunch of kids in a room with no, like, you know, adult leadership or guidance, the one who is the leader is going to be the one who is willing to be the most violent and the most ruthless,
mm-hmm.
because they don't have anyone to show them otherwise, and so they just revert back to their natural instincts of being pack animals, and being like wolves, basically.
Right.
And like everything about that episode made me think that Sung was right, and that there was nothing inherently wrong with them. They were just basically traumatized kids, and they were following their strongest member, who, by nature of being the one who was able to rise to the top based on nothing but his force of personality and his physical superiority, naturally, he's going to be not a nice guy. He's going to be a bad person.
Yeah.
But, like, his second-in-command showed very clearly that they weren't all evil. They were just doing what their leader told them to do, because that's what they had, you know, learned how to do. And
right.
It was just... And, of course, part of it is also just that Brent Spiner has such an enormous screen presence that it's hard not to agree with what he's saying.
Through sheer force of charisma, you will agree with me.
Sort of, yeah. And that, watching that episode just made me kind of sad that the Enterprise characters were so dogmatic in their approach that they were not willing to even consider that maybe they were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's just... The genetic engineering in general is kind of a white elephant in Star Trek, because it's like, sometimes we do it, and sometimes we don't, but there's never really any real explanation of why other species don't do it. I mean, then, of course, you have the Jem'Hadar, and the Jem'Hadar are supposed to be genetically engineered for combat. And, like, you know, the Jem'Hadar are stronger than your average gold shirt, but, you know, you can still take them in a fight. Whereas if you look at the human augments from, like, 300 years previous, they can, you know...
Take a disruptor.
They can be shot by a disruptor and not be too concerned. And it's like, you know, everything we've heard about the Dominion suggests that their technology is comparable or greater than the Federation's technology. And what you're telling me is that they couldn't come up with something as good as what Earth was doing, like, 300 years in the past? So, like, genetic engineering is just a weird thing where it's like... Sometimes, if the Federation can just do it, but they don't because they consider it morally wrong, why aren't the Romulans doing it? Or the Cardassians? I can see the Klingons not doing it, because the Klingons are all about natural strength and honor, and they would probably see genetically engineering as, like, saying that they're weak, and that they need to be made stronger.
Uh-huh.
So it's just one of those things where I think the Star Trek universe would have been better if they hadn't included it, because, like, they threw it in kind of offhand, and they weren't ready for all the implications that genetic engineering brings up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like, episodes... Like, there's some really good stories about genetic engineering. I mean, heck, Gattaca? Yeah, comes to mind, yeah, as a really good story about genetic engineering. And I just feel like it was one of those issues that Star Trek took on and bit off a little more than they could chew. I've gotten a little far off topic here.
It's just we went from children augments to genetic engineering, which is kind of a natural transition, but... Are there any other children?
Well, we haven't talked about... We talked about Wesley and Alexander a little bit last week, but we haven't done that this week.
You want to talk about Wesley?
Eh, we could... A little bit. You actually... I want you to talk about Wesley, because I think this is one of those few instances where most people listening to us will share my opinion of Wesley. I want to know your opinion of Wesley, because yours is a weird...
I view Wesley as being... he's a smart guy. He's a smart kid. You know, and the example I threw out last week was, you know, just going... I went through public school. I didn't go through private school. To public school, there was always, you know, some individuals who, no matter what subject you threw at them, they were good at it. They aced it, no matter what it was. Whether it was because they just sat down for 8 hours a night studying, or they just had a natural talent for it. Just as much as we have prodigies in society. You know, like Mozart. Prodigy, right?
Right.
Totally a prodigy. So why can't Wesley be that?
All right. So, I remember we had this argument last week. I'm just going to say it again. well, and first of all, last week, I will remember that you called everyone who doesn't like Wesley jealous. I just want it known for the record. This is a thing that was said.
Well, yeah. I'm jealous of Wesley Crusher. Heck yeah.
All right. So here's the thing about Wesley. Is that the reason why I don't buy Wesley just being, like, a prodigy is that they don't really act like he's a prodigy. Like, the things that Wesley does... is crazy. Like, you know, to get back to your grades example, getting good grades. I got good grades in history class. I always got A's in history. Always. But, like, the things that Wesley does would be like me bringing in, like, a doctorate thesis about proving once and for all that aliens built the pyramids. And there's a scale here. I mean, Wesley accidentally invented a race of sentient robots. Because of a science experiment he did that went a little bit awry. Not even a lot awry, just a little awry. Mm-hmm. So it's like, he is way too smart. And of course, he's also like the focus of some very unfortunate plots early in the show, like how he can take over the ship with nothing but a voice recorder and, like, you know, and some spit and wire.
Yeah.
And he's also, like, very often the one who comes up with...
Well, again, I plant that squarely on Gene's shoulders.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of the character is his writing, and like I said last week, I don't have a problem with Wesley as he's portrayed later in the show. Mm-hmm. Like, I really like the first duty, and I really think he's good in that episode, and even though the last episode that he's in with the Traveler is a little weird, I don't have a problem with the way he's portrayed there, either. I'm not a big fan of the way he's portrayed. Like, I really don't like that they made him an acting ensign and then a real ensign without him ever going to the academy. It's just like, you know, I feel like, you know, granted he's really smart, but that's just like in violation of all protocol. And, you know, and it's one of the reasons why I really liked Valiant. It's because I think Valiant showed why you shouldn't do that. Just because a kid is really smart, you shouldn't just make them put them in an officer's position without the training. That was the point of Valiant, was you had all these really smart kids who were in officers' positions without the experience.
Right.
So, like, that's, you know, that's just something that...
But, well, the kids on Valiant, though, and I do use kids, maybe we should talk about them for DS9.
Yeah, we should. Let's talk about Valiant. All right.
But the difference between Valiant, the Valiant crew, and the Wesley Crusher is... The Wesley Crusher. Between Wesley Crusher is that Wesley Crusher very much had the guidance... Through his character development, from what we see of it, Valiant, they were just kids. Where the supervising adults were dead, and they were carrying on the best they knew how, mm-hmm. which they thought was to be behind enemy lines,
hunting down this Dominion battleship.
Yeah, let's go take on a Dominion battleship, guys. We can't make warp 3.
Clearly, they'd been watching Deep Space Nine, and they thought the Defiant was like the best ship in the entire universe and could fight anything. They didn't realize that that's just a PC thing. You know, that's just because
they don't have plot armor.
Yeah, they don't have main character shields.
Yeah, and they paid the price for it ultimately. I mean, that's not to say that Wesley Crusher is perfect. I mean, we see him very much getting caught up in the first duty, for instance, in more or less what can be considered a conspiracy to hide what it was that they were doing that led to one of their classmates getting killed.
That's why I really like the first duty, because the first duty is Wesley as an actual person, whereas before then...
In a peer group, his own peer group, mind you.
Whereas, like, you know, I would be totally willing to buy that Wesley is really smart and that he would get great grades at the academy, he would ace all of his courses, and he would make a great officer someday.
Uh-huh.
The fact that he is so good at everything he tries so early is... That just stresses my belief. Like, there are some people who are really good at certain things, like musical prodigies. That's a thing that happens. But those are people who are really good at sort of a specific thing, and when they get discovered, they're a really big deal. Whereas, like, no one really makes that big a deal out of Wesley. And, like, I would think someone who can accidentally create sentient robots would be a really big deal. If for no other reason than because he poses a significant danger to everyone around him. It's like, Wesley, you're not allowed to do science experiments anymore. Your science experiments...
It's true. He plays with antimatter.
Your science experiments are almost as dangerous as the holodeck, Wesley.
Which, by the way, antimatter totally looks like Play-Doh.
Yeah, it does. I mean...
Blue Play-Doh.
Couldn't it technically look like anything? It'd be anti-Play-Doh?
Anti-Play-Doh. I feel this is a conversation I don't want to have.
Let's go. We can go talk to the science channel.
I don't want to talk about anti-Plato. That's kind of, I don't know. That's a little weird. But where were we? We're talking about Wesley.
We're talking about Wesley.
All right. Well, but yeah, I think Wesley was a really good idea that suffered as a result of Gene infusing what he thought he was into him.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that Wesley just doesn't act like he should.
Because I know Gene Roddenberry has said that he very much sees himself in Wesley Crusher. That's something he said.
I remember you saying that last week, and me being like, huh?
Yeah, so.
Ruh-roh.
I mean, that and Gene had a lot of control over the first season, into the first two seasons anyway.
Although,
so.
While we're on the topic of kids I don't like, Alexander never gets better. Alexander just gets worse. The longer Alexander's in the show, the worse he is. Like, I don't mind Alexander when he's actually a small child. As, like, Alexander himself is fine. The thing about Alexander that I hate is I don't like what Alexander says about Worf.
What does he say about Worf?
Well, we had this discussion before, that Worf will just run away from his responsibilities. Because Worf is just like, you know, everything else I've ever seen about Worf suggests that he thinks that family is the most important thing. And that Worf will always take responsibility for whatever it is he's done.
Uh-huh.
But with Alexander, you just can't wait to shove him off the ship. Just like, no, get back to Earth. Get back to go live with my parents. I don't want to deal with you. And it's just, I don't like what that says about Worf. And then, of course, he comes back in Deep Space Nine and is like the not only is he way too old, but he's like the ultimate failure of failures. And it's just like, I can't... Like, I know that the Klingons, you know, the Klingon screening process for who gets to be on their ships during wartime is probably not that, like, you know, stringent. But, I mean, I would think you'd have to pass some basic competency requirements before they would let you on one of their expensive warships.
Well, remember, Alexander wasn't raised by Klingons. He was raised by...
He was raised by humans, and then he went to join the Klingon Defense Forces.
When was that?
It was in Deep Space Nine during the Dominion War. During the arc.
Right, but we see him come back and he's on the Rotaran, or he comes back and serves on the Rotaran.
That's the first one. That's Sons and Daughters.
When did that transition occur? When was the last time we saw Alexander in TNG?
When he was a little kid.
Right, but where in TNG exactly did that happen?
I want to say mid season 5, but I don't have anything to back that up. I'm just pulling that out of my butt.
Okay, so then when's the first time we see him in DS9?
That's about half. That's the end of season 4 into season, or no, end of season 5 into season 6, Sons and Daughters.
Okay, so just at some point he went off and joined the KDF. At some point,
yeah.
Before that,
he was just hanging out on Earth.
So he did go back to Earth then and live with Worf's parents.
He went to Earth. He came back, stayed on the Enterprise a little bit, and then he went back to Earth.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, yeah. So then he was raised by human parents.
Yes. You know. And that's not the problem that I have. I don't have a problem that he's bad at being a Klingon. The issue that I have is that he's bumbling and incompetent. Like, even at things that he's supposed to know how to do.
Well, the question I'm asking is that a result of the environment he grew up in? Or is that just who he is?
It could be either one. But he shouldn't be on a Klingon ship. They shouldn't have put him on that ship. I'm not against the existence of people who are bad at jobs. Speaking of being bad at jobs, I think it's time for us to go. Oh, hi, Stony, in the chat room. Showed up just in time. Should have been here earlier. You could have come to my defense. Everyone was yelling at me.
Well, that's because you're allergic to positive thinking.
True. But anyway, I think we have to close it out. So next week, we will be joined by the GNT show.
We will
talk about The Wrath of Khan.
The Wrath of Khan. It'll be all about Khan!
It was really funny when Bob first messaged me about it. He was like, hey, you want to join up with the GNT to talk about Twok? I was like, what is a Twok?
What is a Twok?
What are you talking about?
The Wrath of Khan. God. Oh my goodness. Alright, so yeah, play you out. What do you want to play him out with?
Do we have Khan?
Do we have Khan? No.
Can we just have Kirk shouting Khan?
You can shout Khan if you want. Do you want to shout Khan in the
microphone? No. Play something fun.
Well, that's a very subjective term, though.
I
have this playlist.
Don't argue.
Pick something off this playlist.
I don't know what any of these songs are.
God.
All right, that one, number 28.
All right, here we go.
Bam.